Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Anish Goda. He's the CEO of Diamond Dare. Diamond Dare is an online platform where you can design your own jewelry. Anish, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thanks a lot, Rohit. Thanks for having me.
So diamonds are not an easy business to get into, right? I have some friends who are into jewelry making. How did you break into this business?
Helps having legacy in the business, actually. So the way we started is my cousin and I, we started DiamondDare.com, and we're the eighth generation of a family business that's been working in the jewelry industry. So DiamondDare.com is a way where we brought the family business into the 21st century using the available tools for us. But the back end supply chain, all that was already existing, so that helped in terms of making sure the product was up to the mark.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about you said you are the eighth generation. Can you tell us more about the previous seven generations? When I go on to your website, it says designing jewelry since 1890s. So I'm assuming that is like the eighth generation from you, which started in 1890. Can you tell us more about the legacy of the family?
Yeah, of course. So our family started off as individual jewelers for royal families and dignitaries across India, and then gradually the world. They used to go to the kings and maharajas, and then be their personal jewelers, make the elaborate sets on a custom order basis. And that was what the family did in the initial period. Fast forward to my dad's generation is when they decided to branch out and start manufacturing for export. So about in 1989 is when they started an export business, where they started exporting low-value products. Low-value is in $500 to $50,000 products for export around the world. They ended up building it, selling to about 20 countries around the world. And the way they work is they were the manufacturers. In each country, they would have a distributor. The distributor would work with the wholesalers, say a wholesale in California. And then the California wholesaler would work with a network of retailers in, say, Palo Alto or Redwood City or San Francisco. And that's where the customer would go in to purchase the jewelry. This was the model that was there in the jewelry industry for a long time. Mm-hmm. But then with the advent of e-commerce and 3D printing and computer-aided design, that model was ripe for disruption, where if a customer walks into a store, he's besides buying the product he's purchasing at a store, mm-hmm. the price of the store, the price of the electricity, the price of the employees, the price of all of that the store has to bear, the cost of the store has to bear, is also factored into the price of the jewelry, or the price of the products that the customer purchases. So which is why if we skip all of that out, we're able to reduce the price passed on to the end consumer, but still offer him a very personalized experience because he's interacting directly with the manufacturers. So that's what was the thesis behind Diamond Dare. And that's where we ended up starting the website. It's a purely e-commerce play direct to consumer about 4 years ago now.
Yeah, so 4 years ago, you saw that there is an opportunity and wanted to start a business, right? So how did that come about? Were you in the entrepreneurial community, or are you familiar with the tech entrepreneurship community? Like, how did that idea become a business?
Yeah, so there was a variety of things that came into place. I had just graduated in my master's degree, when my focus was technology-based entrepreneurship from Stanford. And my cousin had just finished his consulting, job, and then he moved back to India. And he was, we had a conversation essentially where we realized this was an opportunity. And given the back end that was established through the family business, we decided it was the right time to go ahead mm-hmm. and make use of all of the variables that we had to plan, just put it all together and build this company.
So you were... how did you end up in the U.S.? You're not born in the U.S., right?
Yeah, so I was. I grew up in India. I did my high school in India, and then I went to Northwestern for my undergrad studies. And then I went to Stanford for my grad school. And then right after graduating is when we started Damida.
Yeah.
So that was my story.
So after graduation, you must have been on a student visa, or were you in a student visa? How did that let you start your own company? That is one question I get asked a lot.
So I was on a student visa. Student visa has an OPT, optional practical training, which I was on for a year. And then after that, because my degree was in engineering, I had an additional 17 months of STEM. Mm-hmm. Following that, the company was built enough where it could sponsor my own visa. So then the company that we built ended up sponsoring my own visa.
Oh, I see.
So primarily, I mean, the number of sales in terms of, you know, how number of customers in terms of all of that, mm-hmm. we were able to build it to a stage in that time where it was you know, stable enough for the corporation.
Mm. So you were brought up in, you said, India, right? And your family was into diamond business and they were entrepreneurs as well. So did you have like a very luxurious upbringing?
No, not at all. I mean, so the jewelry business has ups and downs, and it depends on the economy as well, right? It's a very cyclical market. And so I think when I was growing up is that's when my father was starting out. One of the reasons he did start out is because there was we come from a very large family. And so there was a separation within the family. And, my father started off doing exports because that was the way forward, is you need to build something from scratch again. Mm. So while we do have a legacy which is passed on to the generations, it's also been split up along the way and to the various people in the generation. So growing up, we actually did not have a very luxurious life. We had about 8 to 9 people living in a 1,500 to 2,000 square foot apartment in Mumbai. That changed very quickly, but not without the hard work of my parents and my uncle and everyone involved in the business before us.
That's a very interesting point that you mentioned. So even if you have a legacy, it's commonly shared between all of the next generation. So if a father has a diamond business and he has like 7 kids, my mother is the youngest of 11. So let's say if someone has 11 kids, so the family business has to be split up into 11. So each one had to, like, if one of the 11 people are more entrepreneurial, it actually benefits them. So that creates an incentive to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yes, exactly. So as your person, you have to understand the resources that you are allocated. You can be start off with a large set of resources, and then if you're not careful with them, by the end of your time, that can end up into nothing, or it can work the other way around. You start off with nothing, and then you can end up building something very valuable out of it. So you understand what resources you've been allocated, and then you try to make the best of what is available to you, and then you move forward. I mean, it's very easy to rest on your laurels as well. Mm. That's something we try to avoid doing. But as long as you have that passion, you have that motivation to create value, to build something out of nothing, then, no matter what you're allocated, however much you're allocated, however little you're allocated, you can do some good.
You said you should not rest on your laurels, right? So I can understand how your dad learned it. Like, it must be experientially, because he was a part of a rather big family, but you for you, it was not the case. How did they teach that to you? I'm curious to know.
So it was... It's an interesting question, because I've tried to ponder about this for a while. Is how do you build motivation in someone? It's just a drive to build something, out of nothing. Like, I get a lot of pleasure in seeing what we create being used and enjoyed by other people, and that's probably why we do what we do every day. I think money is not a motivator enough. Where the saying goes is, if we started this for the sole intention of making money, we probably have given up a long time ago, because it's not enough of a motivation to get up every day and then face the challenges you do every day. You really have to believe in what you do, and you really have to have passion for what you do. And unless you have that, it's the easier paths out there than entrepreneurship, where you can create wealth.
So once you had this idea, right? So you have the family legacy, and also you have this new idea that you can directly go to the end consumer. What was your first step?
So first step was we ended up the idea was to mix both all our legacy together. So the initial part of the legacy was the custom jewelry experience, which we'd offer to the royalty, to dignitaries, to celebrities. That was a very important part. And then the mass manufacturing that was established by my father's business was also a very solid pillar. So we ended up creating a platform where we combined those two, where we could offer customized experience similar to what we could offer to the royals and dignitaries, you know, back in the day. We could offer that to everyone around the world because the technologies that were available to us had essentially made that possible. So that's what was the basis of starting the business. We ended up creating a website where you can change gemstones, you can change the metal, you can engrave on it, which was a very a state-of-the-art website. And still is, because we still keep innovating and coming up with new ways where the consumer experience, at least, is a very simple and very easy one, where it's easier to sit at home and shop online, given the selection, given the customization available, than going into a physical store.
How long it took you to build the initial website?
Our initial website was about 6 months, and then we kept updating the designs. We kept seeing what worked, what didn't work. The website's never complete. You always have to keep working to make things better. Mm-hmm. And that's, once you think the website's complete, is when you start resting on your laurels. Mm-hmm. So the website's always incomplete. You always keep working on improving things, making sure the customer experience is always better, making sure the all your key metrics, your cart abandonment, what our customers say about your website, whatever your customers experience, is always getting better as the day goes on.
Yeah. So your first version of your website was up in 6 months. That's very fast, I would say, right? Because you had the whole customization in the back end and connected it with the e-commerce, and you had the UI. And this was just what did you launch with? Was it the whole portfolio of jewelry, or was it just one portion, like rings or something?
So the jewelry designs actually were legacy designs. What we realized is what we sell online is different from the products that that our parents used to sell, for instance, as a manufacturer. So as a retailer, we sell different designs direct to consumer than what you'd find at retail. So for a variety of reasons, but essentially what we started off with is we took a base e-commerce portal which had your add to cart, your shopping cart, and all of your product listing pages and all of that already built. We took a bare bones version of that, and then we ended up building the customization angle of it, and then the rest was design, making sure that the website was good, looked good, it flowed well, was easy to use. We ended up focusing a lot on that. So the initial 6 months was primarily focused on making additions and building up in-house everything that we could do to build upon that bare bones e-commerce portal that we'd bought.
I see. So only the front end you had to build, right? So on the back end was all already taken care at that time, or did you have to figure out anything in the back end once the order is there?
So e-commerce was a completely new industry for us. No one internally had had built e-commerce from the ground up. So we had to do this internally. We had a lot of challenges which no one had faced before. So it was essentially a completely new company to begin from scratch, where we had a new set of challenges, a new set of issues, different hiring needs, and different issues that popped up every day.
So can you talk about one that popped up in the first 6 months? Can you talk about one that popped up in the first 6 months? One of the big issues that came up.
Yeah, design is something that. So the thing is, average order values for a jewelry company, for a fine jewelry company, is something like $1,500. Right, that's a good amount of money. Compared to if you go on Amazon, or if you compare to go to a jeans website or a t-shirt website, which is $60, $80 at tops. To make sure that the customer had that experience where he was willing to and comfortable with money online, we had to focus a lot on design, not only the design of the products, which is very important, but also the user experience of the website. Right. So a lot of the 6 months was focused on, iterating on the designs to make sure that it felt like the website felt like a luxurious place, similar to how you walk into a luxury store. This had to be a luxury store because that was a customer-facing portal. So we had to make it a luxury store where people had felt delighted to come in, enjoy browsing the products, enjoy going through the website, browsing around the website. And that's a lot harder said than it looks. I mean, you look at a nice website today, you're like, okay, that's cool, right? But when you're trying to build something from scratch, that's a lot harder job than necessary. So we went through about 7 to 8 designers. We took bits and pieces of different designers that we worked with. We ended up getting a lot into design ourselves, and so that was something that we focused heavily on.
Yeah, usually I'd be able to look at an old version of the websites by going to the Internet Archive, but in your website case, I'm not able to look. There is some code blocking me from looking at an old version, so I don't know what it looked like. So
really no, a lot of we had a few articles come out earlier and should be available to you, I think 2 to 3 years ago.
I see.
But they had screenshots of the website, so I'm not sure what.
No, what the articles itself on the current website exist, but there is an Internet website archive where I can go to an older version of the same website, and that seems to have been blocked. But once I placed 6 months ago, based on the platform that you had, how did the logistics work? Once I came and let's say I was a diamond ring purchaser, it's now 2 years, I bought a ring for my wife, diamond ring. I bought it off of the shelf because I'm not big into designing. But if I were to design, I came to your website and I found some design aspects, right? Like I can add lines or I can, like, what are the things that I was able to customize? And once I gave the order, how did the things work in the back end?
Is this 6 months ago or is this today?
Oh, 6 months ago.
Sorry, 6 months
after you launched.
So 6 months after starting the website, we had the customization engine built up at least. And what used to happen is a customer used to come in, select the gemstone, select the metal, engrave on it. A purchase order used to be created. And this is something that, the core backend is still similar. Since when we started about 4 years ago, where it's easy to make changes on any of these designs because it's all on the computer. So back in the day, what used to happen is someone used to sit and draw these designs on paper. Then they would give it to a wax carver who would sit and carve wax pieces, a model essentially of a scale model of that design. It used to take him about a week to carve it out, and then used to create a mold using that wax piece where you filled in liquid gold and that was your ring. And then you set it, polish it, and you have a finished jewelry piece. So that's back in the day. What we ended up doing is we ended up creating all our designs on the computer. So making changes was very easy.
And that was ship new. It to making the designs on the computer, was it new or was your dad's business already doing it?
So jewelry business is computer design and 3D printing in the jewelry business has been around for 10, 15 years.
Okay.
But our feeling was that jewelry manufacturers hadn't tapped into what we could do with this. Once these technologies were developed, you could essentially think of jewelry manufacturing completely new from the ground up. Yeah. What jewelry manufacturers did is they continued business as usual, but just started doing designs on the computer and 3D printing, but then they ended up, doing the one piece for 100 order quantities for each design rather than 100 different designs of one piece each, right? So that's the key differentiating factor that we could do is it's a mindset that you have to think of this from a completely new perspective. You think of this from the ground up. So what happened is we ended up creating these designs on the computer. We sent it to the 3D printer. Instead of taking a week for someone to manually carve it out, you stamp out the wax piece in about 5 minutes. And so then we could create a mold using that, and that was a jewelry piece. So we could create individual orders at scale, given the technology that were available to us. And that's what we built the entire company around. So that's what backend was, at least even back in the day when we started. But as the years rolled on, what we realized is the customization angle was lost in the messaging on the website, at least. So we worked with consumers. We kept making revisions to the website, to the design of the website, where the fact that you can work with the designers to customize pieces completely from the ground up or using any one of our designs as templates, that's what we focused on bringing out more on the website. So that's what focused on, but essentially the backend remains the same.
I see. So jewelry industry was using computer designs, but they were not using the advantage of the computer designs to mass design or mass customize, which is what you started doing. Because you're able to do it in computer, you can do 100 designs rather than just one design.
Exactly. And you see this a lot in industries, right? So if someone's been in the industry for a while, they get so used to the way things are. It's very hard to look at what they do from a fresh set of eyes and identify all the flaws in their day-to-day work. It's because they've gotten so used to it that they are blind to them. So our background my background was in engineering. My cousin's background was also in engineering, and he was a consultant after that. Mm-hmm. So we essentially came to the business with a fresh set of eyes. And understanding technology, understanding business, understanding management, understanding the consumer, all of these coupled with what we saw, we essentially ended up creating a completely new company that it was different, completely different from what people who'd been working with these technologies every day were used to. Mm-hmm. So that's what is if you're an outsider, that's actually a gift to you, because you can see the flaws that are invisible to everyone who's been in the industry for like 20 years.
But you're leveraging your
and you can actually do something about it.
Yeah, but you're leveraging your dad's manufacturing footprint in his company to do the backend. Were they the suppliers to your company, Diamond Deer?
Yeah, so the suppliers were, he worked with a lot of gemstone manufacturers who got it from directly from the mine. So we skipped out all the middlemen there. We worked with the same gemstone suppliers. And then once we had the gemstones, we had bricks of essentially gold. And then that was the input into the factory. And then the output was finished jewelry. And a lot of that was based on technologies that were available to my dad.
Yeah. So you mentioned that initially you started just with diamonds, right? And you figured something that wouldn't work for diamonds. So what was it that was hard about making diamonds business profitable?
So what happened is back in the day, we looked at all the available companies out there. And the diamond industry is a commoditized market. So when a company called Blue Nile started out, which is you can buy diamonds online, they started out back in the day when e-commerce was just new, when Amazon was starting out around those days. People weren't used to e-commerce. People weren't used to buying and selling online. So they ended up selling something commoditized. Diamonds are commoditized because a certain cut, color, clarity of a diamond is going to be the same. Anywhere you buy it from, as long as it has a certificate that says that this is a certain quality of stone. So they end up selling commodities of jewelry online. And that was a good business for them. They ended up building it and scaling it. But by the time we entered the market, that market was already saturated. Diamonds are a very high value item, but the cost of goods is also extremely high. So you end up, you don't end up making too much per item that you sell, even though the top line looks good. That's what we figured out. Is this is something where we were funding it ourselves. This is something where we were doing this as a business, getting it into ourselves. The diamond market was saturated, but what wasn't saturated and what was still in its nascent stage was the colored gemstones market. Colored gemstones are a little bit tricky for the everyday jeweler, primarily because it's very there's specific mines around the world where these gemstones are produced. So mines in Southeast Asia produce very good quality sapphires and rubies. If someone in around the world wants to get access, and they have to work with a network of distributors that go all the way to Southeast Asia. We were already working with the distributors of, we were already working with the producers of these gemstones directly. Mm-hmm. So we had access to high quality stones at a very good price point, and we were able to build a lot of this into our into business by making use of these stones that a lot of jewelers did not have access to, and focusing primarily on these stones. And those, these were not commoditized gemstones. We were able to extract a good price point where it made the business feasible.
When did you introduce the other gemstones? What time frame?
Other gems. So once website, we around with the diamond market for about 6 to 8 months. So I think 1 to 1.5 years of starting the jewelry brand is when we focus heavily on colored gemstones, because we have the price and quality of gemstones, which was very hard to compete with, which other jewelers would find very hard to compete with.
Yeah.
So that's what our strength was, and so we ended up capitalizing on our strengths.
So you seem to be getting a lot of SEO traffic as well, right? So you're ranking very highly on a lot of keywords on Google. So what is your like content strategy like, or content marketing strategy and SEO strategy like?
We have a very good CTO who makes this his day-to-day job. And so we focus very heavily on SEO,
mm-hmm.
On the keywords, on the different different ways to make sure that our traffic gets, that our website gets ranked. It works in a lot of ways. What happens a lot is also people try to research Diamond Air. And not diamond specifically, but it's our research or our jewelry. So what we end up doing is we end up featuring a lot through social media or through all our blogs. We end up focusing a lot with customers on in the research phase. So if you look at best qualities of fine sapphires or ruby or something like that, there was not enough content out there that down for customers. Okay, this is the difference between a good ruby and a bad ruby. It's a good difference between a good sapphire and a bad sapphire. When you're in jewelry, this is what you should think about when you're purchasing different kind of designs. How do different designs work with different, events or parties or dresses or, so that's what we ended up focusing a lot on. And that's where we ended up being ranked higher, is because of our work there.
I see. So
where we help the customer through their research phase, and then
So when did you start doing the content marketing? Did you start it right away, or is it something that you started later?
So we focus on SEO a lot. We focused on social media a lot. We focused on Google Ads a lot, and we focused on creating a lot of content for our customers, primarily because a lot of customers just reach out to us with these questions, and so we end up putting online. This was a mixed effort. So we tried pretty much all the channels that we could think of, and we end up seeing a lot of traction in these different channels.
Okay.
And so that's what we ended up doing. Probably about 2 to 3 years.
I see.
Into learning time does. I mean, learning how business works it does take time. But as long as you are constantly innovating, constantly looking for new opportunities, constantly looking for ways where you can capitalize on your investments, is when you will start to see results.
So you mentioned you tried a lot of different tactics, right? And what is one marketing strategy that didn't work that you had to scrap?
Marketing. So if you look at your business as a whole, you look at your production, you look at marketing, you look at finance, you're sourcing, all of that, you look at it as everything. Once you go on the market, you also have to be aware of what is out in the market. So one marketing strategy that didn't work is we had access to so one of the diamond monopolies is 12 to 15 distributing arms around the world. We had access to one of their arms, and so the natural cause was we have access to such a wide and great source of diamonds that will make sense to go into the diamond space right away. And so that was what we focused on. But what we realized is the market was already extremely saturated, and there was no way that we could differentiate from the others. So in terms of the positioning, it ended up focusing on diamonds more as an adjacent gemstone rather than the center gemstone of a piece of jewelry that we would sell. And we ended up focusing capital design cap a lot more on color gemstones, is because that's where people would struggle to find good jewelry.
I see.
And given our custom element, we could pretty much create anything that our customers requested. So that's where we end up focusing a lot of our efforts on.
Yeah, you seem to be like an aggressive experimenter, right? Like you mentioned yourself also, you're trying to experiment with like a ton of things before you figure out what really works. How do you get into this like mindset of doing such a thing, this agile experimenting kind of mindset?
You have to look at failure, right? How you view failure. Like failure in India, in our culture, is looked down upon. It's not looked at as very favorably. Oh, I tried something and I failed. That's like something not to tell people, you shy away from. But what you realize is failure is a learning experience, right? If you try something and you fail and you learn why it failed, you'll become lots wiser that way. So when you try something new, the probability of success increases with each failure. So it's not a binary number. It's not either I fail or I succeed. It's I fail several times and only then will I succeed. So that's something that keeps you going, is because once you understand that, once you internalize that, then you will keep trying different things, expecting a lot of them to fail. That's okay, because you are just learning, right? And then once you fail a bunch of times, you learn a lot, and then that's when you're able to guide yourself into the right path where it increases succeeding in that same space. So that's pretty much why you should keep experimenting. Is it's a trial and error. Cost of innovation is failure, and that's completely fine. So that's what the mindset needs to be, is try something and it fails, that's completely okay. Understand why it failed and then keep going forward. So that's what you need to do, and that's what you need to keep going. Is that's the only thing.
What are you guys doing in revenue in 2016?
We've almost been doubling our revenues every year. So I think last year we were about at a million, mm-hmm. and this year we're at two. So
over $2 million.
So, I mean, we're still in the early stages, but we're still trying to aggressively.
One thing we didn't mention is that you were funded mostly by your family, right? But did you ever consider taking outside funds to grow your business?
The issue is a lot of early rounds are very dilutive in capital. So we had a laser focus on making sure our unit economics worked, right? Where a lot of e-commerce companies go wrong is they will raise a whole bunch of capital. They will spend it all on Google ads, which are unbelievable. They will see the top line coming up, but it doesn't make sense to spend $1 million on Google ads and then see $3 million in sales and then go around shopping a $3 million amount. That's not a very sustainable business to keep going off on, because once the outside investment stops, that's when you essentially need to consolidate or shut down the company, is because you have to go forward. What we ended up doing is we needed to be very judicious with our capital. We needed to be very disciplined with our capital. And that, if you don't have other people's money, if you have your own money, you will be very careful in where you spend your money. And what we end up doing is we end up focusing a lot on unit economics. We realize that diamonds weren't positive perspective. This wasn't working out. We could have played in that space for a lot longer if we had our money, but it was around money, so we had to keep iterating. We had to keep testing and seeing things that worked, that didn't work, and keep going forward. So we became unit economic positive very early on, like within a year or two, and this we were unit economic positive, which means after you sell goods sold, after you remove cost transition costs, after you remove cost of shipping, insurance, and all of that stuff, all the variable costs, are you still positive? And that was what we had a laser focus on, and we focus, your fixed costs such as salaries and everything else, that's from a company level. But from a unit economics perspective, we had to focus on making sure that the company was at least sustainable in that sense if we kept continuing onwards. So now once we build a business into a sustainable level as we have now, in the future, if we do take money from outside, we will know exactly what to do with it because we have built that discipline into the corporate culture of the company. Mm. Once you, if you build a corporate culture which is used to outside money, and once you build a corporate culture which is used to a lot of capital, and suddenly that capital dries up, it's extremely hard to change that culture.
Mm.
So that's and early rounds are extremely dilutive as well. So you learn a lot, you become disciplined, and then once you have money, you have a lot better way to spend it, and you're a lot more wise when spending it than if you had taken it early on. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons.
So when listening to you say that answer makes me say that you seem to have like a mix of the traditional wisdom that comes with your family business, mixed with the modern mindset of what works in the today's industry and the technology. So these are both in different, there's not that exuberance, right? That the entrepreneur show, I want to raise as much money as possible and want to grow, which comes with as a baggage in the tech industry, for example. So do you consider yourself that way? It's a mixture of old wisdom versus new ideas?
Yeah, because my parents would ground me once I start flying too high. So that helps. So what I'm saying is I've seen a lot of cases of e-commerce companies or startups that scale a group very, they can't sustain themselves. That's what happens, when a large influx of money back, like early on into the business, where you don't sure what to do with it. So we saw a lot of that, and so we tried to make a conscious effort not to be like that. So we can grow slowly, we can grow steadily, but we have to make sure that the business is stable as we keep growing. Mm. So that's the primary reason.
What advice do you have, Anish, for others who are just starting out in e-commerce space?
The e-commerce space is extremely saturated in the sense where you have to figure out you have a one unique insight or a unique perspective or a unique gap where where you can provide value already. So that's one thing. And then two is once you start doing an e-commerce a company based on a specific set of products that are not available or using a specific set of technologies like what we ended up doing with the jewelry business, where you can rethink the product or the industry from the ground up, that's when it makes sense to go and do an e-commerce company. Because it's very easy to think of e-commerce as simply a website. I put my products on it and I have a shopping cart and then that's my e-commerce company. It's very simple to think of e-commerce as that. But as an outsider, but the actual world of e-commerce is extremely complex and it's extremely hard to focus correctly to make sure that your numbers work out, that your math works out from a day-to-day perspective.
Mm, yeah.
That at the end of the day, if you sell something, you should be taking some part of it.
Yeah. Being an outsider myself, and I was just booked you at the guest and I was doing research about you, that's what it felt to me like, right? So. Oh, he has a family legacy and he just created a website which started making money. It seems very simple, but like obviously it's not that simple. Talking to you made me realize that, and also the research I did about you. But what you said, I can relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, well, it's an iceberg effect, right? So success is an iceberg. So when you see only the top part of it, but you miss out all the bottom part, which is probably 5 to 10 times what you see. And then that the part that's hidden is all about failure and experimenting and all of that stuff, right? So that's what success looks easy from the outside. But but we still have a long way to go before we can call ourselves that.
Yeah, my goal here is to bring out both sides of the iceberg, both the top part and the bottom portion, and I hopefully did that today. What if someone listening to us wants to reach out to you, what is the best way for them to connect with you online?
You can reach out to anywhere, just contacting a Diamond Air toll-free number or contacting our Diamond Air email address. That gets sent out to all the relevant people in the company because the company is still small, at a scale enough where it's not going to get lost in the mail. So every one of our emails are looked at and are forwarded on to the appropriate person. That's the best way.
Are you on Twitter or any other social media where people can reach out to you?
On Twitter, I'm on Facebook, and okay. I'm on Instagram as well.
At Twitter, what's your Twitter handle? I'll leave that. I think that will be good for someone to connect.
My Twitter handle is Anish Godha.
Anish Godha. Yeah, I'll leave that in the show notes.
First name.
Yeah, I'll leave that in the show notes. Anish, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.